Evening, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is international flavor, and you are listening to Damn Radio with me. You can follow me at internationalflavor.com. You can also listen on DamnRadio.com/live from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. on Sunday through Thursday nights, Chicago time, that is. This is going to be a pre-recorded show that I am doing tonight. This is going to be a two-hour deep dive, in fact, into the show that we are trying to discuss today. A lot interesting is going on in the world. And I wanted to talk a little bit today at the very beginning about the fact that it was pretty much a nothing burger, wasn't it? So the meeting with Vladimir Putin and Trump in Alaska a whole week ago on Friday, the 15th. Not much has happened since then, has it? We've had some discussions. There's supposed to be some meetings, some possible discussions between important people. Maybe Trump will meet with Zelensky and with Putin to try to get to the bottom of the matter and perhaps resolve some of it. And nothing has happened. We had some meetings with European beggars, basically, begging of the United States to do something about big bad bear Vladimir. Nothing has happened since. We have the same old thing. We have more bombings going on. We have people being arrested for blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines. We've got otherwise not a whole lot going on. When will something happen? That's what I want to know. When will the news come out that says this war is ending and that we can stop the killing of people? What about this 1.7 million number that is being tossed about that the Russian hackers claim to have taken information straight from the Ukrainian numbers from the Ukrainian War Department, basically saying that these are accurate numbers, saying that these are the number of people who have been killed in the conflict on the Ukrainian side. And I mean, that's a terrible number. You know, that's an unbelievable number. And it's something that we all should be somewhat ashamed of. You know, from the Western point of view, they all still want to come around and blame all of this on Big Bad Vlad. And Big Bad Vlad did all of this. It was completely unprovoked, completely one-sided, lopsided, that he had to, you know, he overreacted. He has intentions upon all of Europe. He's not just here to do the things that he says he wants to do. He's lying about all of that. So you have to believe a whole lot of things are nothing but lies from the Vladimir Putin side. And I'm not sure that I'm willing to do that. And I don't think many of us should be, because the lies historically have come from our side anyway. And that is absolutely true. The, you know, I feel sorry for what's going on in Ukraine. I feel sorry for the Ukrainian people that have died. I feel sorry for all of the damage and destruction that has been done to that country. And, you know, I hope that it can be finished. I hope that we can end it. I hope that it will, you know, go, that it can be gone. But so far, it's not. Now, today, I am in Belarus still. Tomorrow morning, I'm taking a train and headed to Moscow. And that should be entertaining. I have an interview on Monday that is going to be, well, it'll probably that'd be midnight on Sundays in for most people. And we want to make sure that people are aware of that so you can keep posted. I want to make sure to put that on my channel so that people can see and read and hear all about my interview with them. That should be pretty interesting. But there's there's so much news to talk about, so many things to discuss. I would love it if there were people to discuss it with, if somebody would log into the program, and you can call in. Call-ins are accepted, and I would be happy to speak with you about these issues. But there's some news about Lukashenko, who he is, has plenty to talk about from our perspective, from our point of view, from the point of view of what his conversation was with Donald Trump, because they had spoken last week sometime. I am moving about the room. I have some things to go get, so if the echo gets to you a little bit, I hope that isn't too horrifying for you to understand and go through. But I do need to get some paperwork that I am wishing to reference while we are going through this show today, because I really want to dig deep. But you know what? I think I'm going to start this show over. I wasn't quite prepared when I sat down for this, and I should have waited until I was, but I wasn't. And it's a very sunny day, and it's very hot in the place where I am sitting. And so I may end up having to go somewhere where it's not so dang hot and sit with you some more. The beautiful part of technology is you can do just about anything you want these days, and always have a technological ability to get it done. I mean, here I am, think about this, talking to most of my listeners are from the United States, and I am in Belarus, discussing things with you from Belarus. And I think that is technology is just unbelievable what there is. Yesterday I went to Brest, and what I saw in Brest and what the history of what we got to know about that was just incredible. If there's ever an opportunity for an American to get somewhere and see true history, I had a discussion with a Yandex driver this morning when he was taking me somewhere to chat about all of the things that he had seen. He, of course, hears my accent speaking Russian and wants to know where I'm from and all of that stuff. And so we got to speaking about it, and he asked me my impressions and asked me about what the major differences were between America and Belarus, Russia, you know, these these places that are, what is so different? Why are people so different? And do we, he asked me an interesting question about why we elected a person like Donald Trump. He said, why would Americans pick somebody like Donald Trump? And you may disagree with what I said to him, but I told him what I thought. And I think that Americans, and again, who am I? Just a lowly radio program guy that gets to tell you his thoughts, and I'm very glad you listen to my thoughts. But my opinion is no more important than anyone else's. You know what I mean? But what I told him was, he said, "Why would you elect a guy like Donald Trump?" I said, "Well, why wouldn't you elect a guy like Donald Trump when your government, like the American government, our government is so, corrupt, I hate using that word corrupt, but is so bought, I suppose would be the best word, by the power that is, that voting for Trump is basically a stick in the eye to everybody that is controlling the system. And Americans got together and put a collective stick in the eye into the Democratic Party and the deep state. Although at the same time, we put a stick in the eye of the rhinos. We put a stick in the eye of the uniparty, you know, this globalist BS, although people could disagree with it. That's what I was doing. Okay. That's it. When I say I'm for Donald Trump, for the most part, it's because I still believe that there wasn't any other choice to make. What are you going to do? Pick more of the same? Just going to pick the same old people that we always pick? Are we just going to keep this same horror story going, where America's been bought and paid for by the same families forever? He asked, it was a very interesting question, this cab driver. He said, "Well, but don't you think," he said, "do you think Trump will run for a third term? And you are going to be looking at a kingdom as well, or one of his children, or something like that." I said, "Well, it happened with the Bush family." I said, "Well, heck, we almost got Jeb Bush after George Bush, Bush II, whatever president number he was, 43, I think he was, I don't remember, but it's." Apparently, we have pretty short memories. You know, my rule has always been, for a long time, I do not vote for the same person more than two terms. Okay. So just because the president is limited in being president more than two terms, I don't have to vote against a third term for a president. But even if there was no such rule, I would still vote against a third term for any particular president. I just would. And I do not agree, and I will never vote for somebody that's just a Republican, because I lean Republican. I still vote the person. And if the person has been in office more than or is at the end of his second term, or having been elected twice, then I will not put my vote out for a third. That's my small form of democratic protest, because I think that the stagnation that has occurred, particularly in our country, particularly over the last 30 years, that brought us Joe Biden, that brought us Nancy Pelosi, that brought us the Lindsey Grahams of the world, that brought us these people that get into office and stay there forever. That is the problem with American alleged democracy. The only way you can get to the table is to kiss the rear end of the power that is. And once you're in the power, the game is to keep it and to keep that power rolling in. And how do you keep that power? You keep paying for the same old programs that always have been. You keep paying for Ukraine. You create an enemy in Russia that doesn't exist. You create the unipolar world, the unilateral party, unipolar, the uniparty, the unipolar world. There is no sovereignty anywhere. If you aren't for this globalist theme, then you're not part of the in crowd, at least if you're in the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and arguably in the judiciary. And what's pretty funny is nobody ever pays any attention to the judiciary. Nobody really worries too much about it. They are not somebody that the other two branches of government pay much attention to, and they probably should, and should regulate them far more than they do, and see what happens. Because I think that the creation of the uniparty, the creation of the unipolar world, has in large part been made possible by the same old in the judicial branch as well. So anyway, I had an interesting discussion with this cab driver about the Donald Trump, and he said to me, he goes, "Listen, I'm not against Donald Trump. I don't think he's bad. He's probably good for your country, but I don't understand, why you would take somebody that's all about the money." And I said, "Well, I said here are a couple of positives from my point of view. Let's take the positives of Donald Trump. Is he's not them. You know, the more they hate him, the more I like him. You know, the friends of my enemy, the friends of are my enemy are my enemy. How does that work? Or the enemy of my enemy is my friend, however you want to put it. But if Donald Trump is changing about what he is planning on doing, I'm sorry, I got a call coming in at the same time here, and I don't like it because I can't push pause. Trying to fix that right now and see what I can do about it. But I bet that won't happen. So let's see what we need and figure out how we can do it. So sorry to be interrupted there in my train of thought. I may have to stop. May have to stop and regroup in a few minutes, but I'm not so positive it's going to work. At any rate, I lost my train of thought, and I very much apologize for that, but let's try to get back to it, okay? Like I said, there's plenty of news going on in the world that we can talk about, and I wanted to get to, if at all possible today, because I don't want to be an I told you so type of guy, but we have all this discussion from last Friday, all the discussion over the week, all of the drama of, bringing in the cheerleading squad and the band pep rally people from the European community, along with Zelensky. And what has happened since? Seriously, has anything happened since, or is it all just one big fat nothing burger? Nothing accomplished, nothing done. And it's depressing to me because I thought there was some momentum going there, and apparently there is not any momentum. And that's unfortunate because the possibilities were endless. So now what's going to happen? Does this mean that Trump is going to cut off Zelensky, cut off Ukraine? Or are we still going to be having the money paid through NATO to buy U.S. weapons to deliver to Ukraine? Is that what's going to happen? And more people are just going to continue to die? Is that the plan? That appears to be the plan from my point of view. I don't see anything different. Does anyone else? I'd be happy to discuss that. If you wish to send your commentary, you can do it to SamuelT@internationalflavor.com, and I would be happy to listen to you and read your commentary on the air. And is there any news at all? Anything about what happened? Anything that we can talk about and say something has happened in the week since? Has anything happened since the meeting that we had last Friday between Putin and Trump in Alaska? Has anything happened to stop this war, really? Let's talk about neutrality, right? Has the West, what are all these talks on neutrality, right? Think about this. Here's a guy named Alexander Bobrov. He's a PhD in history. He's head of diplomatic studies. And he has written an article, an opinion piece. And I'd like to share a lot of that with you. I wanted to say, because I feel the same way. I feel the same way about this that he does. And he's put it in a pretty good way. If you haven't had a chance to read it, haven't heard of it even, perhaps you need to. And here's, I mean, what do we have? Before we do that, let's get to any news. Remember, I'm trying to find if there's any real news that occurred in an effort to end this war, right? The U.S. is in talks about what the Ukrainian security role for the United States is going to be, right? Ukrainian locals are fighting off conscription officers. That hasn't changed. A top CIA analyst, the one behind Russiagate, somebody lost a job finally, right? Let's see. German opposition parties are slamming EU hypocrisy, right? About Ukraine specifically. Ukraine, for its part, if you want to argue that, and this I think is mostly because of Trump, you know, and what he has forced upon them. But there's an article about Ukraine being ready to accept a frontline freeze and this was a top Zelensky aide. We'll get to some of that article. But other than that, where is the news about the war, coming to an end? Huh? I mean, what is there? The Ukrainians are still bombing the hell out of former Ukrainian, now Russian territories. A Ukrainian terrorist cell was dismantled in the Donbass regions. There are what else? I don't know. I just don't know what else there is. Let's see. The family of an American killed fighting for Russia received a medal from Putin. We'll talk about that. Because that was an interesting article. I'm not so sure that's not the right thing to do. Lavrov has outlined the terms for a Putin and Zelensky meeting. Zelensky says he'll meet with Putin, but not in Moscow. Ukraine isn't interested in peace. I mean, these are headlines, right? What are we getting from these headlines that is saying that Trump's efforts have been successful in any way? Seriously, what are we getting to here? There's nothing there. One big fat nothing burger for us all. So let's read about, if you would like to, well, even if you wouldn't like to, because I'm going to tell you about it anyway. The usual thugs all showed up in Washington, right? The European cheerleading squad trying to get something more freebies for Zelensky and trying to somehow keep Donald Trump in line on their own. They haven't been very successful at that, by the way. But at the Washington, here's this guy's article. Again, his name is Alexander Bobrov. And at the Washington summit on Monday, one guest stood out. The extended session of Euro-Atlantic leaders hastily convened at the White House right after Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Zelensky brought together the usual heavyweights: the U.S., Britain, Germany, France, Italy, as well as the heads of the NATO and the EU. Yet at that same table was someone who, at first glance, excuse me, didn't seem to belong in that club: Finland's president, Alexander Stubb. Now, he was there, and I heard, when I watched that half-hour discussion where Trump let everyone say a few words, he even gave Mr. Stubb an opportunity to speak as well, and he did. He gave his opinion. He talked a little bit. Nothing dramatic, nothing even memorable, and everybody got their chance to say something. But there he was sitting here, and this guy's going to say why, okay? To an outsider, it may have looked odd. Why is the Finnish leader invited when leaders of Poland, Hungary, and the Baltic states were not? The answer lies not in protocol, but in the role Stubb now plays. His presence was a nod to a man whose career embodies the whole project of Euro-Atlantic solidarity, a project now under strain since Trump's return to the White House. Stubb is a cosmopolitan in every sense. A Swedish Finn, oops, I went too far. Technology catching up to me. Married to a Briton, educated in South Carolina. A golfer who bonded to Trump on the green, but also a foreign minister of the late 2000s. Stubb has become a rare kind of advisor. Someone Trump listens to on European security, an administration where career diplomats are absent. Ain't that true? It is telling that the Washington summit did not produce a U.S. ultimatum forcing Ukraine into a peace deal with Moscow. This is what I've been suggesting all along needed to happen, by the way, is that somebody needs to force Ukraine into a peace deal. And that somebody is unfortunately Donald Trump. There's no avoiding that. And it's he's not going to force Putin to do anything. And I mean Trump. Trump is not going to force Putin into doing anything. They're not going to force Lavrov. Everybody knows what it takes to end this conflict. And nobody has taken a serious stab at getting it done. So maybe this stub guy is for this reason. That's why this article is interesting to me. And, you know, I don't know true or not true, but I do like the perspective that comes from it. Okay. So instead of an ultimatum, the focus was on designing a security guarantee for Kyiv. An alternative of some sort to NATO's Article 5, right? Since membership in the alliance is no longer on the table for Ukraine. And behind that shift, many suspect, is Stubb. He is becoming the architect of a new Western security system built on an openly anti-Russian foundation. Stubb's Finlandization 2.0. Okay, in Washington, Stubb, and I hope I'm saying that right. I've heard it said both ways, Stubb and Stubb. But in Washington, Stubb framed his vision in a phrase that quickly went viral. We found a solution in 1944, and I believe we can find one in 2025. How do you like that? It's actually, you know, sounds pretty good. He is alluding to Finland's peace treaty with the USSR after World War II, and he is suggesting that Ukraine could follow a similar path. But here's the catch. Stubb's vision of Finlandization bears little resemblance to the original concept. And, you know, that concept has hurt Finland recently. You know, it's what happened on the Finland border after the Ukrainian war and after Finland became a focus after the Ukraine, the increase in hostilities, if you want to call it that, after 2022 is sad for both sides, truthfully. But anyway, Stubb's version of Finlandization bears little resemblance to the original concept from the 1944 version. In his model, Ukraine would follow Finland's supposed example, joining the EU and NATO, becoming part of the Western economic and military infrastructure, and then in practice turn itself into a forward operating base against Moscow. That vision assumes a militarized society, stripped of industrial potential and defined by an ethno-national identity designed to fence out Russian influence through the Russian-speaking population. This is not Finlandization. It is the opposite. The original model, coined during the Cold War, describes something quite different. A small country leveraging its geography to live in peace with a powerful neighbor. After 1944, Finland accepted tough compromise, ceding 10% of its territory, declaring neutrality, abandoning the dream of ethnic exclusivity. The payoff was stability, prosperity, and the chance to serve as a bridge between the East and the West. Helsinki became a symbol of détente in 75 when it hosted the CSCE final act, a milestone in Cold War diplomacy. Finland's economic boom, from Nokia to Valio, from Stockman to Tikkurila, I don't know which that one is, was meted in precisely that balancing act, trading and cooperating with both blocs, and especially with nearby Leningrad, St. Petersburg. Neutrality allowed Finland to spend less on guns and more on butter, and the choice paid off. Could such a model have worked if, back in 1944, Finnish leadership had doubled down on nationalism? Certainly not. It took Marshal Mannerheim's pragmatism and readiness to compromise to give Finland a viable future. Real Finlandization, as Ukraine's only way out. This is an interesting perspective and a very formidable idea. Let's call it that. This is why Stubbs' rhetoric is misleading. The real Finlandization, not his rebranded version, might be the only path for Ukraine's survival and recovery. That means a recognition of facts on the ground. It means a neutral, non-nuclear status. It means rejecting neo-Nazi ideology and building a multi-ethnic society where the rights of Russian speakers are protected. All the things that Russia's been asking for since 2014. It means diversifying trade, not just westward, but eastward. And they don't want that. They want to only go west. They've taught their children for the last 30 years that Russia is horrible, that Russia is the bad guy, that there was no great patriotic war from your side. Nonsense, all of it. But this is what's going on. So this is not a list of Russian demands, as Western commentators like to say, you know, when I say things like that. It's a recipe for economic revival, drawn from Ukraine's own founding documents. In 1990, Kiev's Declaration of Sovereignty defined the country as non-nuclear and neutral. As Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov reminded, if Ukraine abandons those principles that it keeps pursuing in NATO-style guarantees, including nuclear deployments, the very basis on which its independence was recognized, will collapse. That would create an entirely new strategic reality. I don't understand how this is difficult for people to understand. This makes complete sense to me, which is why it's, and he's saying it in a far better way than I could if I didn't sit down. I mean, I suppose I could put this together if I sat down and put my thoughts together, but I don't think that way. I think more in a round robin kind of way, which is why I think it's important for me to share ideas that I come across that I think are poignant and pertinent. And this one definitely is. So if you want to figure out why Ukraine is failing, it's because 30 years ago they said, we want to be non-nuclear, we want to be neutral, because we know we're in between Europe and Russia. And then they've had several leaders in between there that have tried to be on both sides of the fence, much as Lukashenko is in Belarus, because they still have a lot of eastward-looking ties, eastward friendships, but they haven't dug a hole for themselves and being only NATO. They haven't demonized Russia. And I'm in Belarus right now. It's doing just fine. There, you know, you may agree or disagree with Lukashenko. I don't care, you know, but the fact is he's in charge. And so you deal with that. Who do we have in charge in America? You act like we don't have that kind of an issue. If you disagree with the power that is, well, that's too bad. You still got to deal with it. And that is not something that Ukraine has been willing to do. And it's a huge mistake that they made by assisting and by encouraging every step of the way, creating an enemy in Russia that does not exist. And then looking west and training their children in schools, changing all of their textbooks to honor Nazi guidelines, to honor the SS symbols and the Nazi symbols and all of that, and demonize Russia's part in their history and take a valuable part of that culture away from their own children. And so this is what when Vladimir Putin talks of root causes, this is a root cause. And this is why it's important that people need to think about this. And I've deviated from the article I was reading, but I also wanted to make sure that you understand my point of view and why this is correct, why what this person is saying is correct. You know, it came from where did this one come from? This one came from RT, Russia Today, that the U.S. doesn't want you to hear. You know, and when I talked to Scott Ritter, he says, "Oh, you mean the truth?" Basically, is how he said it. Yeah, well, they put out more or less the truth. And by the way, they do, or at least they give people the ability to say some things. And on their side, they're right this time. Not that they haven't been before, but they're absolutely right. And so everything that we are talking about are things that, and I think Trump is realizing it. And now, and you know, I was hopeful that there might be a meeting as quick as a week away. You know what I mean? As quickly as a week from the 15th until the present. Wouldn't that have been nice that we could meet or have had a meeting between Putin and Zelensky and maybe even Trump to try to finalize this war? I think he's slow playing it. And as this article pointed out, somebody needs to force the Z-man to just make a deal to accept what the U.S. has created, or what Donald Trump has created with or has discussed, you know, no ceasefire, a deal, end this thing, end it now. And here's how we end it. Right. And I think that would have been better had he said that on Monday to all the European leaders. Anyway, let's get back to the part where, put simply, Ukraine faces a choice. Either it embraces real Finlandization, not the current kind, but the kind that existed after World War II, that consisted of neutrality, balance, and prosperity, or it accepts Stubbs' distorted version, becoming a permanent frontline state in a Western war against Russia. That seems to be the way that everybody has been looking and hoping that to go. And so that is why this Stubbs guy was present, because he is a border country. He is. And by the way, I read some articles to you several months ago about what has happened in Finland since the 2022 increase in hostilities in Ukraine. It has become, you know, they're both upping on each side of the border, putting things in place that never existed before, putting military bases in place, increasing the number of people that soldiers that are present, that are there on location. Nonsense, because they didn't need that before. Russia has never treated them. I mean, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's been, pretty much free transport back and forth, easy to get back and forth. Not anymore. Now we got problems. And that is truly unfortunate. But I do hope you enjoyed that article. I think it is well worth putting together. Let's talk about this terrorist cell that was dismantled. The video of it all is pretty graphic. You know, these guys were hauled out naked. They were hauled out with no clothes on. And it's a hell of a deal. I mean, you couldn't put some clothes on these guys before you hauled them out. So Russian law enforcement broke up a Ukrainian intelligence cell in the Donbass responsible for attempted assassination of Russian officials and was planning further attacks, the Federal Security Service said. In a statement Friday, that's today, FSB said it uncovered an agent group of Ukraine's main intelligence directorate operating in Donetsk People's Republic. The group included two Russian nationals who were aged 38-28, who were allegedly involved in car bombings in March and December of 2024, targeting the Kherson region government employee and a former senior official of Russia's Federal Penitentiary Service in Donetsk. The FSB said the men had also prepared attacks against the head of the municipal administration in Donetsk and an unnamed commander of a volunteer battalion. And so they have quite some video of this. The 38-year-old suspect, a resident of Donetsk, was recruited by Ukrainian intelligence in 2022 and tasked with organizing terrorist attacks, recruiting accomplices, and distributing explosive devices, said the FSB. The 28-year-old was said to have twice traveled to Moscow in 2023 to gather intelligence on the whereabouts of an unnamed Russian journalist, because they want to kill journalists too. The suspects face charges of treason, terrorism, illegal circulation of explosives. They will face life in prison if convicted. The agency released a video, which I saw, showed a large group of heavily armed operatives entering a building in Donetsk and escorting, they weren't escorting a suspect from the apartment. They dragged him out naked, if you wanted to see that. But when asked if he knew why he was being detained, the man replied that he assumed it was blowing up somebody in Donetsk. The video showed what appeared to be one of the suspects planting an explosive device under a car. Then a man that some reports claim was a Russian official approached the vehicle, which exploded as he tried to get in. Multiple occasions have seen Moscow accuse Kiev of attempting to stage terrorist plots against senior military personnel, civilian officials, and those with opinions, as well as to sabotage critical infrastructure. Isn't that loopy? It is what's happening, though, just so you know. Let's see. Oops. There's also some videos, and if you get a chance to watch these, you really should go watch them. These are horrifying, you know, in my opinion, okay? I don't know what Ukraine can do about this kind of thing, but it sucks that you know, they're losing that. How do I want to put this? I don't mean to say it sucks that they're losing the war. We want the war over. The war needs to be over. And there are people who are abandoning their positions on the front lines. That's going on quite a bit. There are people who are, surrendering. And there are people who are fighting off conscription. There are people who are paying to get out of the country. So first thing you do is you bribe your conscription officer. You got to pay your local conscription officer so his wife can have great big puffy lips that she gets injected in so that they can have nice furniture, good dacha, you know, nice places to live. So you got to pay them off. They have to get rich. I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. You pay them off. And that's how the system works. Then you, you might have to pay another person or even the same guy again, you got to somehow get out of the country. So how do you do that? You run to the border, and upon information and belief, let's call it that, there are people who pay $8,000 to $10,000 to get out of the country. They pay the $8,000 to $10,000, and out they get. I know several who claim that that's what they've done themselves. Then they escape to some Western European or Canada or United States where they can start getting freebies. In the U for U program in America, you can get free stuff from most of the European community if you're a refugee. And so hopefully you can get over there and not have to work and try to earn your money back that you spent, $4,000 or $5,000 paying your conscription officer. You spent $8,000 to $10,000 to get out of the country. I spoke to a couple of people who got into the United States. There's a guy who came to the border every day. And this was during the Biden administration, admittedly. But he came to the border every day. And then finally, after they canceled him every single day and told him he couldn't come in, one of the people at the border told him, you need to buy a car. If you buy a car, you can get in. Then you just, you know, go through Tijuana, go through Nogales, go through, El Paso. Go to one of those places and keep coming in. You might have to do it every day. And sure enough, that's what he did. He said that he went back. He and his family bought a car. It was him, his wife, his wife's dad, I think, and then a kid or two. I don't remember if he had one kid or two. But he said that they then daily would make three or four attempts to cross the border, get in line, wait, and until finally they were given, after however many attempts, I don't remember the exact amount. I want to say he told me it took him less than 2 weeks of every day going through, and he'd get a different guard. Remember, if you're into travel, And if you travel a lot on your passport, especially with American passport, you might know how this works. Okay. But we are treated differently. We sometimes don't need visas. We just, you know, sometimes you pay some money and you get in, but it's the cost of getting in. It's like a tourist visa costs you $75 in some places. But most time you just show your ID and they stamp you. Now, if I'm coming to Belarus, I have to have a visa, and I have a Russian visa that has probably, I don't remember, 8-10 months left on it before it expires, and then I have to get another one. And that visa allows me into Belarus too, Belarus. I can get into Belarus. And so I have to show that at the border. And over the last few years, since 2022, the questioning at the border has been, well, interesting, to put it mildly. This last time coming in, I flew into Vilnius, Lithuania, right? Took a bus across the border from Vilnius, across the border and to Minsk in Belarus. And at the border, I crossed. They don't see American passports up there. And I have a visa, Russian visa, so I'm eligible. You know, I'm not doing anything wrong. You know, you come in that way, but most people come in through the airport or do something else. Well, when the border guard checking me out, I gave her my passport, which has my visa right in it. And she saw it. She says, "What are you coming for?" I said, "Tourism." And she says, "Well, how long are you going to be here?" I told her. She says, "What are you going to be doing?" I told her, "Tourism. You know, I want to see some history and want to go through stuff like that." She has the discretion to allow me in. She also has the right to ask me questions, but she didn't. She asked me a couple of questions, you know, "Where are you going? What are you doing?" And then she just stared at my passport for a while, several minutes, in fact, and then she just stamped it, handed it back to me. Well, the same thing goes with our border patrol. If you're coming through the airport for any country and you doing your entrance to get into whatever country you're coming into, that guard there has the authority to detain you, to pull you aside, to have you interviewed. Last year, when I was coming through to get to Kazan at the airport, they held me at the airport and had another person, the next level up, some security officer, come and talk to me for a little while. And, you know, he wanted to look in my phone, wanted to do stuff like that, which is all fine. Also last year, I came in by highway from Georgia through Ossetia, Abkhazia, I don't remember, through there's a little disputed territory between Georgia and Russia, and I drove through there. And there it took me an hour. You know, sitting in there, I had to wait for somebody to come, and there were cars backed up forever. The car that was given a ride almost left and didn't want to wait anymore. And it was like the other people that were in the car were going, "Why are we waiting for this guy? You know, it's not our fault that they wanted to leave." The guy didn't leave, and I appreciate that. But it was interesting because I was being quizzed because of politics going on between two countries. So if these people can go and have the discretion to get in to the United States, then they're here legally, right? So this guy that I was telling you about gets into America finally, and that gives him a date on a card to come in and be seen. But it also means he's here legally. And if you're here legally, there's a lot that you can do. And so if you've been inspected by a border agent, that means you are here legally, okay? If you overstay, then you are illegal. But you're not an illegal alien just because you crossed the border. And so Republicans, and in part I agree with this anyway, you know, we just opened the borders, and the person in charge, the person in charge is the executive branch official, Donald Trump. And if he says nobody's allowed in, then nobody's allowed in. And he can say nobody's illegals aren't crossing the border Well, they're not illegal if you've allowed them in, right? And if they overstay, then they become illegal. Anyway, if you can get there legally, that's what you do. So the game with these Ukrainian officials who avoid the conscription by paying money, selling their apartment, paying money, selling their car, paying the money, giving it all to the conscription officer. And then after that, going to the border, escaping somehow, paying the border guard to get yourself and your family out, then somehow making your way to Mexico and coming up through the border, buying a car, hit and miss every single day until they let you in. Suddenly, you're in the United States legally, whereupon you can apply for the U4U program, because now you can claim that you are a refugee and you can do your refugee official and get out of there. So all of that backdrop to tell you that Ukrainian locals who are being conscripted to fill the holes in the gaps in the front line are, still fighting them off. It is still a regular occurrence that they are fighting people off. And so, let's see here. Where did my, darn it, my computer screen just went black. So we shall start again. And, see if we can't join back in to our regularly scheduled programming, which is me. So let's get to where I was, which would be pretty simple. There it is. Okay. So now we're going to talk about Poltava, which is where these Ukrainian locals, where this process first starts. First, they have to avoid conscription officers. So at the very first step, if you don't have money and you can't pay to not be conscripted and sent to the front line to die, then you're going to be taken there. Plenty of videos, if you have a chance to get on and look at them. You can find them on YouTube. They're far, but YouTube blocks a hell of a lot of them. They're far more prevalent on Telegram, if you can get to Telegram. And just go look for Ukrainians fighting off recruitment or conscription officers. And look for the one in Poltava, right? And civilians managed to stop. Like now there are passers-by, women and men, jumping these conscription officers to make sure that the local guy doesn't get dragged off to the front lines. So here it is in another video. Ukrainian civilians managed to fight off conscription officers and stop the man from being forcibly taken away on Wednesday, according to a video that emerged online. I've seen it. Kyiv's mobilization drive, supervised by the Territorial Center of Recruitment and Social Support, it's a great name, has grown increasingly brutal as Ukrainian forces have faced setbacks and troop shortages on the battlefield. Campaign is marred by hundreds of instances of TCR officers beating. And I mean beating. These are not, you know, you're getting slapped around. You're getting beaten, kicked, dragged. These are bad. Has grown increasingly brutal as Ukrainian forces have faced setbacks. Campaign is hundreds of instances where they're beating the draftees, chasing them in the streets, and getting into altercations and threatening bystanders who try to interfere. Many of these encounters are caught on video because everybody is a TikTok star or a Telegram star. A local Telegram channel shared a video Wednesday that shows an attempted forced conscription in the city of Gorishny Plavny in Ukraine's Poltava region. At 7:27 in the park, on the way to church, a TCR officer and police officer tried to put a man in a blue van. A second officer was in the car, the Telegram channel wrote. The man was on his way to work. And it shows all these women and men jumping him. Let's see. And it's in Ukrainian, so I can't read it. I had to read the report. One of the officers used pepper spray on the man, and bystanders got involved and managed to fight the officers off. Ukraine's forced conscription campaign has led to widespread discontent in the country, and the TCR's practice of grabbing people off the street is called busification. At least 650,000 fighting-aged Ukrainian men have fled the country in 3.5 years of the conflict, said the Telegraph last week. And think about that number, people, 650,000. They're claiming that 1.7 million are dead. 650,000 have left, and all of their money has been given to border guards and to these conscription guys. These people are getting rich, but they're not the ones fighting. You know, they don't rotate out. They just go beat people up and throw them into the meat grinder on the front line. And I'm going to share that article with you again on the 1.7 million troops from the leaked documents. We're going to talk about that again because it's Sunday, and as part of this deep dive, we're going to go all the way. I'm pre-recording this actually on Friday afternoon, but this is for Sunday night's show that I want to share with you. And so if anything has happened to change anything between Friday and Sunday, I apologize. But so far, there's nothing changed. But I want to make sure that this is pre-recorded and put out. And again, I wanted to let you know at about 1 hour in, which is where we are right now, that you can always listen to my program on damradio.com/live on Sunday through Thursday nights from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. That's Chicago time for those of you who are interested. And you can also go to internationalflavor.com and listen to all the old shows in order. Well, I suppose you could mix them all up. You don't have to do it all in order. But all of my old shows are out there, and you can listen to them as well. We shall add, we will go into the 1.7 million troops again because I think it needs to be shared. According to Ukrainian MP Anna Skorohod, desertions are rising sharply as the situation at the front deteriorates. There are reports, I heard 600,000, but she says nearly 400,000 Ukrainian soldiers have left their units without official leave, she said earlier this month. I wonder if they're talking about the people who have abandoned before that, because they're saying that now it's 400,000. Maybe she's adding since the whole time it was 600, but I heard different numbers at the beginning of the week of what those numbers really were. We're going to share again these leaked documents on Ukraine and their 1.7 million troop loss as well. Ukraine has allegedly lost more than 1.7 million troops that are killed and missing. You know, this includes the missing also. Say multiple media outlets that is citing a digital card index from the armed forces itself. And this came from Russian hacker groups that claim to have obtained the information by gaining access to the personal computers and local network of the Ukrainian general staff. The database is said to include the full names of deceased soldiers, the description of the circumstances and places of their death or disappearance, the personal data, the next of kin, and photos of them. The entries suggest that since the escalation in 2022, Kyiv has lost a total of 1,721,000 servicemen, with 120,000 plus or minus killed in 2022, 405,000 in 2023, 595,000 in 2024, and so far this year, 621,000 in 2025. So it's not getting better. It is getting worse. Hackers from the group Killnet, Pollock Pro, UserSec, and Beregini are said to have obtained terabytes of info about the Ukrainian military. I wonder if they're going to release it somewhere. if they're going to put it out on a website somewhere that you can pay to access. I don't know. Aside from personnel losses, the group also possesses the personnel data of the command of the Special Operation Forces and the main intelligence directorate, listing all countries that supplied weapons to Kyiv and all weapons transferred from 2022 to 2025. This casualty estimate far exceeds losses reported by Kyiv. And Zelensky himself is living in a dream world. You know, in February, he said that the number, you know, he told CBS that since 2022, and he said that was just this year, he said this, and it was 3 years then. He's saying in 3 years that only 46,000 soldiers had been killed and 380,000 wounded. These are complete lies that he was pumping sunshine up the butt of CBS News. The estimate was questioned then. I certainly questioned it. I said I didn't question it. I downright called him a liar. I said, that's not accurate, not remotely. And Francis Le Monde reported last month that the real death toll is much higher, and citing Ukraine's increased efforts just to build military cemeteries. I read that article to you a couple of weeks ago. Russian military has consistently reported a much higher casualties among Ukrainian servicemen and claimed that their losses surged following the unsuccessful counteroperation in 2023. Hell, they said that after the Kursk operation began, there were nearly 70,000 dead Ukrainian men, soldiers, just in Kursk. Just in Kursk from August of last year until December. Crazy. So this war needs to end. And, you know, so far, we have no real news on that end. I mean, what has happened this week? Seriously, we had the meeting. The meeting occurred, you know, in the White House. And then what? What happened after that? Nothing exciting has happened after that. So let's talk about Russiagate. Why don't we get to Russiagate? So the Economist is saying that this officer that lost her job played a key role in the claims that Moscow meddled in the 2016 election against the old Hillary monster, and Trump won in 2016. But why? Because of Russian disinformation, because Russia stole the election from Hillary Clinton. Hillary was in election denial forever. And after 2000, or 2020, I mean, when everybody was saying, wait a minute, that ain't right with what happened when Biden won and shouldn't have, and nobody believes he did. Well, now people are much more willing to believe that some shenanigans were going on the other side. And now finally, somebody lost a job. Holy crap, is somebody going to be held accountable? Unbelievable. Unheard of, unprecedented, that people are going to be held accountable. Oh my goodness. One of the CIA's senior Russia analysts lost her job during President Trump's damn campaign to depoliticize intelligence, The Economist reported on Thursday. The officer's identity was not disclosed, but she oversaw the drafting of a report accused Russia of interfering in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. Oh my God, did this really happen? Who'd have thunk it? Who could believe it? The Economist described her as the country's top intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia, who coordinated operations related to the former Soviet Union, according to the outlet. Her security clearance was revoked on August 19, along with 36 other current and former officials. Well, you know, that's one way to fight these a-holes, is to revoke their clearances, because that is greatly in control of the president to grant or deny, right? The Kremlin denied the allegations of election meddling, of course, while Trump and the Republicans denounced them, these things, as a hoax put together by Barack Obama and Democrats to delegitimize Trump's first election victory and to undermine his presidency. Can you believe that sort of thing happens in America? I can't imagine that such things occur in America. We have a thriving democracy where these sorts of things just cannot occur. Can they? You know why they occur? They occur because you're always voting in the same assholes. Quit voting in the same a-holes and move on to somebody else. Put together, use my example if you must, or create your own. Never vote for this for the incumbent. Give him one shot. Let him be reelected to a second term. But after that, don't vote him in. Now, I've had arguments with this about this with people whose opinions I respect. And they say, well, but don't you want some kind of a professional that turns out to be a professional politician? If that is what we got, sure. But that's not what you get. You get complete a-holes who all they're doing is looking for, they're jockeying for the next position. Look at, I mean, let's pick Josh Hawley, Missouri, you know, fair golden child, right? All he's doing right now, everything he does is to get recognition so that next time he can throw his hat in the ring to be the president. That's it. He ain't doing it for you. There ain't a damn thing he's doing for you. He's doing it because it will look good for the next level. He wants to look, and I don't mean to pick on him. A lot of people are doing that. He's just pretty good at it. You'll always see him with his glad handing somebody. You'll always see that. That's just what he does. And more power to him. Good luck to him. You know, good for him. But don't act like he's doing this for you, people, because he's not. Nothing that he does is done for you. Everything that he does is looking for the next level. And so that some these people need to be stopped, because if it ever becomes about you, then you have a real person. You know, like the cab driver said to me today, and why would I pick somebody? Why would I support? Why would Americans support somebody like Donald Trump? Part of it is because we romantically want nostalgically to believe that our country isn't the shit show it has become with a corrupt judiciary, a corrupt executive branch, and a very corrupt legislative branch. All of them are in a shambles. All of them are run by people who either are the rings of power or kiss the rings of power, neither of which are who you need to run a country. You need people to run the country who are people of principle and of value. And those values only are good, in my opinion, for a limited period of time. And they don't exist after a certain period of time. Now, remember, I've said that I think that everybody who gets into government service ought to be limited to 20 years no matter what. That you can't work for the government for more than 20 years. Give them a full retirement afterward. You can't do it. You can't be associated with it. You can't do anything. And in any sort of positions, you can't do it for longer than 20 years. Now, you know, let's say you get elected into your last position at 19. You know, and I'm not creating this plan. I'm just saying that I think it ought to be something similar. So if you get elected in your 19th year to a position that takes 4 years or 6 years, fine, finish out your term. But that's the end. You can't run again. You got to get out. We don't want Nancy Pelosi sitting there for 50 years. We don't want freaking Mitch McConnell in there forever. Are you kidding me? These people are worthless as tits on a bull. You don't want them in there forever. They don't do anything except more of the same. They create your globalism. They're destroying the world and arguably the U.S. right along with it. But used to be they could get away with it, but we could go into a lecture on that topic another day, and we will when we get into BRICS one more time this week. But no BRICS today. We're still on the topic of Ukraine and how zero has happened since all of my prep and all of my excitement about what was going on in Alaska. Nothing burger ever since. Instead, we're still here. Wow. Anyway, Since mid-July, the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, has released multiple documents she claims exposed a coordinated effort by senior Obama officials to accuse Trump of colluding with Russia. Earlier this week, she announced, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, which oversees 18 agencies, is going to be reduced by 50%. The U.S. intelligence community has become plagued with unauthorized intelligence leaks, politicization, and weaponization of intelligence. I would argue that it certainly lacks intelligence. That'd be me. Gabbard said the Foreign Malign Influence Center, FMIC, created by Congress in the wake of Russiagate, will be significantly scaled back and stripped of some of its core functions. And it needs to be. You know, it says, remember, Trump has said, and there's this cool, what would you call it? What do they call those things where you draw boxes and arrows and it's a flow, like a flow chart, I suppose it would be, that you have this flow chart of the, that's available online and you can read it. It's a, that Tulsi Gabbard put out that you can, I'm going to save the image. Maybe I'll use it as the cover for tonight's show. That would be fun, wouldn't it? And, I think I will save it as one of the logos and maybe see if I can put that, that in as one of the, we're going to call it Russia Gate and see if I can put it on as the logo. Damn it. It only saved as gate. Remember, but well, I'm a poor typist. Boy, I just remembered something from the Army. But I won't share it with you because it involves the use of some bad words, and so I'm not going to include it. But let's say about President Donald Trump has said his 2016 election rival Hillary Clinton and former President Barack Obama and others involved in the Russiagate affair should pay a big price for orchestrating what he has called a deliberate attempt to sabotage his presidency. Hard to believe, isn't it, that something like this could happen in America? Oh, no. In an interview Friday with Newsmax host Rob Finnerty, Trump commented on newly declassified material from the annex to special counsel John Durham's 2023 report on the Russiagate hoax that ties Clinton's 2016 campaign and senior Obama-era officials to a coordinated effort to link Trump to Russia. Well, I don't know that that's a bad thing, even if they do link him to Russia. But who really gives a rip? You know, Russia, we've turned into an enemy that wasn't anyway. So Trump has resisted that, you know, that has happened. But here's some of his quotes. Ready? I think they should pay a price. By the way, it's a very big price. So maybe he's going to make them pay a price. For that to have gone on, it's one of the great scandals, I think, in the history of our country. I know it is, he said. Trump accused Obama of personally approving and encouraging Clinton's plan to fabricate claims of Russian collusion, citing declassified documents released this week by Senator Chuck Grassley. Obama knew about it. We have him cold. Durham has it in writing. You could almost say that Obama was more of the mastermind. He heard what she was doing, and then he approved it. Not only approved it, he pushed it, according to Trump. Trump described the campaign as totally fake conspiracy. Oh, I like how Trump talks. This totally fake conspiracy that inflicted immense damage on innocent people and on the country itself. When asked whether Clinton should face consequences, what do you think he said? He recalled choosing not to pursue criminal charges after his 2016 victory, despite pressure from his supporters to lock her up. I had her right under the sights, and I told people, look, you can't do this to an ex-president's wife. And I let Hillary off the hook, he said. And then I came in, and they did the same thing to me. The difference is they meant it. They came after him, right? Isn't that terrible? And I really do think that's terrible. That's why I think we shouldn't do it even now. And I hate, you know, people accuse me of playing nice guy or trying to get, but at what point does it end? At what point do you stop upping the ante? And everybody says this, that and people like me get beat up for it, and rightly so, you know, but I don't know the right answer. But man, I think it's just dirty and nasty to do the same thing to others just because they did it to you. And I don't know, I've never been the biggest of turn the other cheek sorts of people, but assholes are out there. Bad people are out there. Perhaps part of the game is trying not to become one yourself. Maybe we do need an a-hole nowadays. I don't know. Despite his calls for accountability, Trump emphasized that he will not interfere with the legal process. He said the decision on indictment would rest with Attorney General Bondi, whom he said is doing a terrific job. His interview follows declassification of documents by Director of Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, which alleged that Clinton's operatives, with assistance from George Soros-linked organizations, orchestrated the Trump-Russia narrative and expected the FBI to play an active role in advancing it. Isn't that terrible? I can't imagine that we have to put up with these things in America. But we do. These things happen all of the time. And I don't think they're going to get rid of it. Where's Lindsey Graham these days? Have we heard anything from him lately? And let's see. I wanted to – I shared with you a little bit about the EU leaders and going to Washington to cry about security guarantees. And I think for them, this something has to happen. What security guarantees means, what they really mean by security guarantee is Western Europe through NATO funding America's military-industrial complex. Well, I was watching Trump's meeting the other day with all these EU leaders. And if you haven't watched it, there's a good half-hour version that you can go and at least see the opening legs of it all, right? Where Trump goes around the table and lets everybody speak. If you haven't seen it, you probably should. I thought about playing it for you, and maybe I will at some point this week, just because it's comical. And if nothing happens, I probably will, because I was certainly expecting something to happen a little quicker. And maybe I was too optimistic for the wheels to spin, and they didn't spin. Nothing has happened. But security guarantees is really just Western Europe funding the military-industrial complex of America. And, you know, call it a good deal on behalf of Trump, right? It doesn't end the war in Ukraine. In fact, it'll prolong it. But if Trump agrees to sell $100 million worth of more weapons to Ukraine, and his big point of it is saying, well, wait a minute, we're not paying for it, and so therefore, you know, we're not involved. I suppose that's true, but agreeing to sell it, the fact is the EU couldn't get it from anywhere else except us. And arguably, you know, if they do get it from us, it's going to – the spares are already gone. By all estimates, all of the spares that the U.S. military had in Europe and here are gone. Patriots, what were they saying? The Patriots were going to take 6 years to get the amount of Patriots that the Z-Man is after because Russia's already blown them all up. Think of all the Patriot systems that Russia has taken out. And some of the other countries don't want to give up their Patriots. They're going, no, we're not giving our Patriots up. What are you, nuts? What if Russia comes after us in 2030 like we claim? I don't believe that to be true. I think they're all nuts. But they're not giving them up, and so they want to buy them direct from us. They want to buy whatever spares the U.S. has, but we don't have any spares either. All our spares were already in Europe. And so the only way to get them is to produce more, and they can't produce them fast enough to get Ukraine what they want. So if we're given $100 million worth of weaponry out of our already short supply to Ukraine, funded by NATO, are we really not involved? Or are we actually involved? On the other hand, we are involved. Curious, isn't it? So anyway, this $100 million is one. But here, there's a second part to part two to that is, first of all, part one, remember, is security guarantee really means NATO funding U.S. military industrial through the 5% increase in NATO funding. And all this is good financially. You know, it doesn't pay any attention to global economics at all. But for the U.S., it actually may stop part of the decline, right, of what we're, because we're selling another product to the rest of the West. Okay. But on part two of that same equation is, peace in Ukraine is going to destroy the EU anyway. Okay? They can't have peace in Ukraine, or the EU is hosed. Okay? And this idea has been bashed around a little bit, passed around, and there are people that are saying that, geez, they have to have the war, or that Europe itself cannot continue to develop, cannot continue to, I don't know what, spend more money and whatnot. It's totally less than helpful for the EU and for NATO if the war ends in Ukraine, especially with them not getting back any of the resources that Russia has taken the territories for, the uranium, the nuclear power plant, any other places, right, that they have lost. But if they keep on in this chain, they could also lose Odessa. And that's a long shot, in my opinion, and always has been. But if they're going to continue on in this respect, it's a possibility. So, but the prospects for an end of the Ukrainian war have never been so good. Although I wonder what the hell's happened in this past week. Despite, the fact that European attempts to play spoiler through they want to continue the war, they want to continue it, but there's still a good chance that this war will be over, right? There's an almost peace. There's an almost peace movement. Like, geez, we're close. People like me, even. And initially, I was extremely cynical about the meeting in Alaska. Anyway, and then I was like, wow, that may have actually something come out. Now I'm back to cynic. I don't want to be a cynic. I want to be the guy that goes, man, it's freaking great. Trump got something done. But so far, there's nothing there. However, they're still saying there's still a real chance that the presidents of Russia and, the U.S., Putin and Trump, will persuade, if you wish to say, both of the Zelensky regime in Kiev and the remaining NATO EU Europe group to return to reality, to accept defeat, accept the fact that Russia is winning the war on the ground, and that peace will only bring losses for Ukraine to an end. Don't you think that would be a good thing? But it also brings an end to these, to the losses of these Western European losers, right? They will quit losing, right? Peace is still in the future, I hope. We can already think about the consequences of peace. Regarding the 32 European countries that are in NATO, the EU, or both, this is usually done with an eye toward military posture, foreign policy, and the economy. How long will it take for the hysterical predictions of a Russian attack on Warsaw, Berlin, and Luxembourg to wear off? These people have been lying about this since the beginning of this. This is what justified the war. Fight them now in Ukraine, says Lindsey Graham, or expect them in Europe. Russia had never had any intention of going to Europe. They didn't even want to go here, right? And so how long is it going to take for this to wear off? What will happen to the new debt-driven monster of militarism? Will NATO and the EU Europeans ever be sensible enough to discover diplomacy and cooperate with Russia? If so, when? Before or after they collapse under the weight of energy prices, paid to the U.S., by the way, deindustrialization and their own public debt? You know, they're funding money through the EU to have advanced military on a stupid belief that Russia wants to come to Warsaw and come to Berlin and come to Luxembourg or Paris. Nonsense, every bit of it. And these are the assholes pushing this agenda. They're the people from the EU, the people that visited Trump in the office with Zelensky. Somebody, and I think it's going to have to be, and I said this last week, and nothing has happened. Maybe it's just not quick enough for me. That Putin and Trump need to just force it and say, here's what we have decided. Rest of you can kiss our hairy white behinds. This is it. We've decided and it's done. And if you don't like it, lump it, because we're going to cut you off. We're not going to sell you another $100 million worth of weapons because we're low on ours in the U.S. And we think it's foolish to think that war, that you need to plan for war in 2030. Anyway, you want to continue to buy our weapons outside of that? Fine. But we're going to make sure that our supplies are stocked up first. Because remember, Hegseth said not 2 months ago, said that there wasn't enough weaponry or to spare in the U.S., right? Russia, meanwhile, is producing on all cylinders, right? They're doing pretty well. The answer to all the questions above will depend on how the domestic politics of key European states develop, right? In that respect, the single most important question about the future of Europe is currently rising. Even the new right, which is an umbrella term for parties that are commonly labeled right, populist, hard right, far right, same as here in the United States, the Trumpster, right? But this logic also works the other way around. If the Ukraine war ends mostly on Moscow's terms, as now supported even by Washington, this peace will inevitably influence politics inside NATO, EU, Europe, and in particular, the chances of the new right. Now they're no longer mutually exclusive. They're one movement, don't you think? The new right advance is especially significant in France, Germany, and Great Britain. They have in common their respective new right parties called Rassemblement National, Reform UK, and Alternative for Deutschland. They are all leading in national polls. While this is similar to several other European groups such as Spain and Austria, the British, French, and German cases are special because their economic and political weight. The new right surge is not new. It's been building for 20 years. And some observers have already said that it is accomplished. It was last spring in the run-up to the EU parliamentary election that Politico even acknowledged that the long-standing effort to keep the new right out of government is officially over. That turned out to be a little premature. In Austria, Germany, and France, current government setups are still based on excluding the new right. Yet sometimes another word for premature is prophetic. The pressure from the new right parties has not slackened, but has gone up. Current measures to ignore their popular backing at all costs have a whiff of despair about them. Take, for instance, the case of Germany and Romania. For Ian Bremmer, a popular American geopolitical consultant, commentator, and reliable organ of the centrist mainstream party line, they stand for success in fending off the new right. Yet ironically, in both cases, not for the reasons Bremmer imagines. In Germany and Romania, elections this year produce centrist governments despite a rise in support of the far right. What he forgets to mention is that in both cases, these victories were the outcome of foul play. This is what happened. You know, like in America, they have to attack Trump in order to beat the far right. But it's happening all over the world. In Romania, on the fringes of the EU, the methods used were particularly brutal and shameless. A massive challenge from the new right under Gorgescu could only be stopped by flagrant lawfare. Without it, Bucharest would already have a new right president, just like Warsaw. In Germany, the land of order and rules, things are only a little more subtle. To keep Berlin centrist, despite the electoral breakthrough of the AfD, two things were done. One merely against the spirit of the Constitution, the other in all likelihood amounting to either literally unbelievable incompetence or deliberate electoral falsification. The so-called firewall, an establishment policy to treat AfD unlike all other parties and exclude it from coalition building, is an offense to basic fairness as well as German constitutional substance, since it treats the votes of AfD voters as having lesser weight. This makes a real and decisive difference. Without this firewall, the new right centrist coalition would already be in charge in Berlin. Isn't this nuts, people? They're actually doing it in other countries. People are starting to think of their own countries first, and the globalists don't like it, and the centrists do not like it. The Clintons and Obamas of the world do not like it. The other dirty trick, without which the current German government could not have been made, was to misplace a large number of votes. No one knows exactly how many because the urgently needed nationwide recount was stalled. For its insurgent challenger from the left, Sarah Wagenknecht's BSW, otherwise the BSW would almost certainly have taken enough seats in the new parliament to make the current ruling coalition arithmetically impossible. German democracy has the dubious, yet not unique, distinction of having systematically disadvantaged both the new right and new left parties to save itself from, in effect, its own citizens. Isn't this nuts? Add the case of France, another country where an electoral outcome was manipulated shamelessly, in effect, to disenfranchise both the new right and new left voters. And the question becomes even more obvious. How much more of this kind of chicanery before the word democracy loses any meaning it may still have? Crucially, the methods that Europe's centrists use to hold back the new right's advance undermine the centrist credibility and increase that of the new right, not to even speak of the obvious boost that the European new right is getting from the success of the U.S. counterpart. So here we are, driven by voters' concerns over immigration. This is Europe too, people. See if any of this rings a bell in America, okay? Driven by voter concerns over immigration, the economy, social and cultural norms, and the general failure of cynical elites to care, Europe's new right is on the offensive. Centrist defenses are desperate and counterproductive, and help from daddy across the Atlantic won't come for the centrists, but for the new right. While its lead is not overwhelming, and the timelines of national elections, as well as the complications of coalition buildings, mean it's too early for firm predictions, one thing is clear. There's a real possibility that one or several domestic politics earthquakes with far-reaching consequences are on the horizon for international politics. Isn't that the truth? It's no wonder that Russian leadership makes no secret out of watching attentively, as is its right. In fact, duty as a matter of due diligence to its own foreign policy. Because the obvious question is, what would new right participation in or domination of government mean in France, in Germany, or in Britain, the three problem-ridden but comparatively powerful NATO countries that are home to Europe's biggest economies and have traditionally set much of the political tone? What would the effect be of an end to the war in Ukraine? In effect, a Russian victory on the new right's chances to make these earthquakes actually happen. I think they go up hugely. In France, Germany, and Great Britain, centrist politicians and their mainstream media have long charged the new right was serving Russia. The same thing they did in America. Trump is Russia. Trump is Putin. You are a Putin lover if you say anything about it. But Russia is nationalist. Russia is patriotic. America is patriotic. And most of the right people are not necessarily bashing other places. They just say it shouldn't be a sin or against the law or a crime to support your own nationality and not destroy it on purpose. What's wrong with that? They're seeing it all over the place. France, Germany, Great Britain, Romania. Think about it. Moldova. Pick them. They're all seeing it. But the only people they want to support it for is Ukraine. We're supposed to be Ukra-nationalisti, ultra-Ukrainian nationalists. We're supposed to be flying the swastika if we're in Ukraine. We're supposed to be having SS symbols in our military units if we're in Ukraine. But everywhere else, if you speak nationalism, you're a bad guy. But not so in Ukraine. But this whole story is about defeating that sort of coalition building. But the right is the right, and the right is growing. The pendulum is going to the right now. And of course, it will always go back to the left. That's what it does. You know, it'll go there, and we will talk about it. In France, Germany, and Great Britain, centrist politicians and the mainstream media, same in America, friends and neighbors, have long charged the new right of serving Russia. Genuine affinities and ideological and political aims, whether you like or dislike those aims is a different matter, have been maliciously misread as, in effect, nothing but an outcome of Russian subterfuge and bribery, right? Russia, Russia, Russia. Russia has done all of this. Russia gate, Russia controlling American elections, right? This same logic never applies to the massive, almost indecent overlap of centrist positions that has produced, for instance, Atlanticism. If Europeans align with Washington positions, as the rule implies, that must be their free choice, right? They weren't influenced. There, it wasn't America, America, America. You know, it wasn't U.S., 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 Russia, Russia, Russia. But in Europe, you're allowed to be you know, subversive. You're allowed to kiss the rear end of Donald Trump and come over and slobber all over yourself. You're allowed to force Zelensky to wear a freaking suit coat. Holy crap. Now that's some kissing ass, don't you think? Whew, you got that guy in a suit coat? Wow, that's really doing something. You have changed the world right there. Such free choice could not possibly have anything to do with American influence channeled through, for instance, U.S. Agency for International Development, mainstream media, global think tanks, and of course, covert organizations as well, the CIA, anybody? But if Europeans even show a desire to at least understand Moscow's position, that must be something that only a big bad Russian has made them do, right? In this regard, an end of the Ukraine war is likely to deprive European and American centrists of one of their favorite tools of neo-McCarthyite new right bashing. In Britain, for instance, the ruling Labour Party has just started a fresh new campaign explicitly geared toward damaging Reform UK and its leader, Nigel Farage, by hammering the local version of the draft Russia, Russia, Russia theme. Now, if any of you haven't listened to Nigel Farage, you probably should. He's extremely interesting and funny. He's fun to listen to. He's certainly channeling Donald Trump. Maybe I shall play some of him on my show as well, because I like listening to him and I think he's funny. And he makes a lot of good points. But it's like Trump with a British accent, only he has a, I don't mean this too horribly, Trump, has a larger vocabulary, you know. His vocabulary is a little bigger than Trump's. In the German AfD, some politicians seen as too close to Russia have been marginalized to create an overall less Russia-friendly image. But fortunately, that is a surface effect due to media pressure. Recent ex-posts by the AfD's single most important leader, Alice Weidel. Weidel has not stopped criticizing the aggressive course of the German government and its waste of billions on arming Ukraine. She keeps demanding normalization with Russia through a realistic foreign policy focused on German national interests, like why are we paying a 15% premium on buying gas and oil products from the United States when we could get it 15% cheaper from Russia? Because we're stupid and we're Europe and we got to kiss the ring of daddy across the pond. Crazy. Peace in and over Ukraine is very likely to benefit Europe's new right and make life harder for European centrists. That's why they're fighting so hard to get the Trumpster to keep the war going. Centrists will lose one of their main instruments of whipping up war scares among the population. The new right will be less vulnerable to smears of being Russia's fifth column, and while realistic and constructive positions on policy toward Russia will become only more plausible. Finally, once peace does actually happen, the war and those in the West who provoked and prolonged it may finally come under the intense scrutiny they deserve, Lindsey Graham, Blumenthal. Come on. An honest, critical assessment of the bloody centrist war folly, including politicians, alleged experts, and those in the global media mainstream variety, would further undermine the hold of the centrists, which are the globalists, which are the deep staters. Everyone knows that the Ukraine war brought great change to Europe, and so might Ukraine peace. Don't you think? I don't know. I enjoyed that thought process brought to you by a gentleman I like to follow and his opinions, and I like to share them with people because sometimes you just need to, right? It's by a guy named Tariq Cyril Amar, And I always try to share his articles with you because he's pretty smart and correct in this respect. So I like it when people are correct. And maybe I'm under the influence of Russia, but Amar. I don't know. Maybe so. That could be bad, people. What if I have to take other people's opinions, read them all, and decide which ones work for me? Holy crap. Is that called something along the lines of a thought process and how people should engage in their own thought processes? Isn't that called critical thinking? Is analyzing the opinions and discussions of other people, hopefully getting as much as you can straight from the horse's mouth, and which I try to do. I like listening to them, but I haven't seen anything new on that side either. I mean, there's nothing other than more stuff. You know, there's an alleged, let's see. There was an interesting article I also read, because a king came to Moscow, right? And this King Sultan from Malaysia, King Sultan Ibrahim, was the first visit by a monarch since the two countries established diplomatic relations in 67. He came to Russia. How do you like that? That's an interesting article, but I feel like I'm getting out of the where I wanted to be. There was a cult massacre that we should probably read something about in Kenya. There's the Nord Stream 2 guy I was going to share with you. Italian media have published his photo. His photo is out there, okay? Several Italian outlets Friday released an image showing the Ukrainian man arrested a day earlier, that's yesterday, over his involvement in Nord Stream pipeline. The man, identified by the media as 49-year-old Sergei Kuznetsov, is suspected of leading a team that sabotaged the pipeline in September of 22. The image published by La Stampa and Open Online appears to be a police mugshot or a photo from other identity documents. Neither outlet disclosed where they got it. Kuznetsov, was detained near Rimini on Thursday under a European arrest warrant issued this month by German prosecutors. They allege he helped plant explosives on the pipeline near Denmark's Bornholm Island. And they disabled three of the four Nord Stream lines. The man allegedly oversaw divers that placed the explosives from a sailing yacht he rented using forged documents in Rostock, Germany. Crazy stuff. It actually showed the explosion on a little video. According to the Italian media, the suspect entered Italy under the alias name of Sergei Kulinik with his family on a tour booked through booking.com. Authorities reportedly tracked his movement until his name, which had been recorded in a local hotel guest database, triggered an Interpol alert. He reportedly offered no resistance, handed over documents, phones, computers, tablets, and credit cards upon his arrest. He faces charges under German law for causing an explosion, anti-constitutional sabotage, and destruction of infrastructure, offenses that carry a 15-year sentence. He's expected to appear at the Bologna Court of Appeal later on Friday, that's today, for a hearing to validate his arrest and set his date for extradition to Germany. But La Stampa also reported he was being investigated in a separate case by general prosecutor's office over a February bombing that damaged the Sea Jewel, a Maltese flag tanker off the coast of Savona. The Nord Stream explosions were seen at the time as an attack on critical energy infrastructure and an example of rising economic fallout of the Ukraine conflict. Speaking in February 2022, President Joe Biden declared the event of an all-out military conflict between Russia and Ukraine, there will no longer be a Nord Stream. We will bring an end to it. In 2023, veteran investigative journalist Seymour Hersh published a report claiming that Biden had given the order to destroy the gas connectors, a claim dismissed as complete fiction by the White House. According to an informed source who talked with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, the explosives, which reportedly caused blasts of 2.3 and 2.1 on the Richter scale, were planted by U.S. Navy divers months previously under cover of NATO exercises. Frankly, I find that more likely because these things don't just blow up. Some guy goes and puts some bombs under there. You need something a hell of a lot more than what you can put on a sailboat. That's what I think. Swedish engineer Eric Anderson, who led the first and only independent forensic investigation at the blast site, told an Italian journalist, "The more I look into this, the more I feel that the Nord Stream attack is part of a bigger scheme to cut off Russia from Europe." Also, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov earlier laughed off the claims that a small group of divers could have carried out such an attack and says that theory is ridiculous. I shared that with you previously, and I think it is worth noting because that article, that was last year when that one came out. He said, "Anybody who believes such stories are afraid of the truth and are shielding the Kyiv regime." And he laughed them off as ridiculous, saying that Nord Stream pipelines were blown up by a small group of divers from a little boat. Remember that article? When did that come out? Let's see, I found my reference to it. That was, that was dated 12 September 2024. Is when he said that. Crazy stuff. Crazy. But you got to pin it on somebody. So it wouldn't surprise me if they're still not going to try to. But back then, Lavrov claimed that five people were sitting around drinking, having a laugh, and decided, "I know, why don't we blow up the Nord Stream pipeline?" They had diving skills, allegedly hired a little boat, sailed to the place where Nord Stream was passing by, went down, planted explosives, and detonated them. If someone can actually believe this version, then it's people who are afraid of the truth and are trying to protect a criminal Kyiv regime in any way possible, he said. "We will not abandon this topic," he said. "We will continue to seek a transparent investigation, which is being blocked in every possible way by the U.S., Britain, and their allies." And he claimed the fact that activists say they can do this is complete nonsense. And he insists that the explosions were carried out by professionals supported by the full might of the state, which has certain technologies in abundance. Well, folks, friends and neighbors, I hope you have enjoyed the program today. My name is Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. You are listening to Damn Radio, and I'm damn glad to have you. You can always listen by going to damradio.com/live. We have great music lineups all the time, and you can listen to us and our music. We also have a very good lineup of talk hosts that have their own programs and great interviews on various topics, a lot of them focusing on the state of Missouri, some focusing on the United States of America, and me focusing somewhat internationally. I strongly encourage you to listen to us. If you go out to internationalflavor.com, you will find all of my prior shows out there. And you will also find if you go to YouTube at Samuel Trapp, you can find some Russian versions. I try to do Russian versions of my programs pretty frequently as well, so that people can share thoughts across countries and in different languages. I want people to understand that Americans aren't all ignorant of the goings-on of the world. I think there are quite a few of them, and I like to see that things are changing for us, and I think that there's a good way to go traveling. I'm coming to you live, well, actually recorded at this point, from the country of Belarus. I'm in Minsk. I've had a great time here. I'm on my way to Moscow in the morning. Continue to report from there. So I appreciate you, and you have a very nice day.